You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Are we all on? Okay. Welcome to this panel discussion about the, what is this thing called? Copyright Online Infringement, Combating Online Infringement and Counterfeits Act, S-3804. My name is Greg Piper. I'm a reporter for Warren Communications News. We're going to be talking about, does this bill actually have any teeth? Is it going to work? Is it going to be subverted? So we have a very nice panel here with you. I'll give you a quick introduction of these folks, let them do an introduction, and then we'll go into discussion. Starting over here, David Sohn from the Center for Democracy and Technology, Andrew Pincus, Meyer Brown, Dan Kaminsky from Dux Para, also known for the Kaminsky bug, and Daniel Castro, Technology and Innovation Foundation. So why don't we go ahead and just do quick introductions here, talk a little bit about this issue and various perspectives, a couple minutes each, and then we'll kind of go back and forth and talk to each other, and then we'll let you talk to us at the end. David, why don't you start?
Sure. So I support the goal of reducing copyright infringement, and I agree that there's lots of infringement out there and that there are certainly bad sites that exist pretty much solely for the purpose of facilitating infringement. I have serious concerns about COICA, though, based on the specific mechanisms that it proposes to address this issue, and in particular, its focus on domain name blocking and domain name seizure. My concern with that tactic is, number one, that I think it won't be effective. It will be quickly and easily circumvented by both the bad sites and by the users who want to reach them. Because, for example, telling an ISP to block a domain name lookup doesn't actually remove the site from the internet. What will end up happening, at the end of the day, the bad sites will continue to be available. Information on how to reach those sites will also be easily available. And simple tools will be developed that make it really easy for people to reach them. And when I say easy, I mean really easy. I mean to the point where anybody that's sophisticated enough to engage in online infringement in the first place is not going to have any trouble finding the infringement sites that they want to find. At the same time, I think that approaching this through the domain name side threatens collateral damage in a number of ways. There are technical considerations, for example, for cybersecurity. I expect Dan Kaminsky will tell us a little bit about that. I think there will be an impact on lawful activity and lawful speech. I think it'll end up affecting much more than just infringing content. And there's international considerations, because I think we should be asking the question, what happens if other countries broadly follow this approach? Do we end up with a more balkanized internet? And then finally, there's some cost considerations, simply because the companies that the third-party companies that DOJ serves orders on under this bill will bear some costs in essentially enforcing the bill. So big picture is, I think, if you look at it in terms of a cost-benefit analysis, focusing on domain names just doesn't make sense. It's not actually going to have a lasting impact on the problem of infringement, and it's going to create new problems of its own. And then just one final point, the bill is sometimes talked about as if it only targets the worst of the worst, the sites that are really doing nothing but infringement. I think if you actually look at the bill as drafted, it's not clearly limited that way. There's really nothing particularly narrow about the bill's approach, and it could be brought to bear against a wide range of sites. So that's a concern as well. Thanks.
Okay. Andrew.
Okay, I guess I have a slightly different perspective, not surprisingly. I think everyone says they want to do something about copyright infringement is a bad thing, and the question is there something effective that can be done about it? To me, the best way to look at this bill is, can we do to sites that are located outside the U.S., and are not either registered here or hosted here, the same things we can do to sites in the U.S., recognizing that even within the U.S., remedies are ineffective, and although domain names can be forfeited and seized, the same kind of cat-and-mouse activity can go on. The question to me is, shouldn't we at least be able to say we have rules that allow government to act against sites that are doing these illegal things in the U.S., we need equally effective rules for dealing with sites outside the U.S. And I think that's basically what the bill is designed to do in a nutshell. And to me, that should be a pretty non-controversial goal. And unfortunately, just because of the legal regimes, the remedies can't be exactly identical. There may be just practical problems with, for example, having the forfeiture of domain name standard that you have within the U.S. outside. And so people have tried to come up with things that are equivalent, and that's the source of the blocking and the dealing with financial and other third-party providers to provide a way to basically disable the foreign sites in the same way that the domestic sites can be disabled, just recognizing the legal differences between the two. I guess some of the critiques about too broad, I don't know, it seems to me that the definition is primarily designed or has no demonstrable commercially significant purpose other than infringement. Seems pretty targeted to me. First Amendment, I think, again, we're just trying to have the same kinds of remedies, the same results for sites within the U.S. as outside the U.S. That seems like something where, and I think the case law indicates, we can get into it if people want, pretty clearly not a First Amendment problem. And in terms of the international precedent, again, it seems to me pretty powerful that, A, the standards that are being applied are standards that are in treaties that hundreds of countries, more than 150 countries, I guess, adhere to, and also, again, standards that we apply in our own country given the First Amendment constraints against which we operate. So just to set some of the parameters of the debate.
Sure. Dan?
Hello, everyone. My name is Dan Kaminsky. I am the engineer on this panel. And if the question is, will COICA effectively stop online piracy, the answer is a flat no. There is no debate about this. The ease of getting around, as has been mentioned, the ease of getting around these filters is trivial. In less than 60 seconds, an alternative DNS can be selected, and in the presence of such a highly visible, highly onerous blockage in front of a user, will be selected. The problem is this. It's not merely that this will not work. It is that the side effects are expensive and dangerous. I'm not here to argue the civil libertarian perspective. I'm here to argue the security perspective. I put a lot of effort, and a lot of people put a lot of effort, into protecting the DNS from a very significant flaw that would have allowed anyone around the world to have hijacked your bank, your search engine, or whatnot. This was done about 2.5 years ago at enormous expense. This bill will drive large numbers of users into using foreign name servers. It will hand our internet access over to others. Because at the end of the day, if it is the case, in fact, that users are highly desiring of this content, they will take the 60-second step that it takes to actually do this. We have hard data that shows that when DNS filters go into place, it causes a couple-hour disruption of traffic, and then everything goes back to normal. Taking these extraordinary steps not only will move our internet access over to foreign entities, it will also blind us to what is actually happening on our networks. I've actually spoken to network engineers who've told me, and I quote, "We are terrified of losing the visibility into our networks from losing users using our name servers." The final thing I want to point out is that the United States is in a unique position from a diplomatic point of view. We have a certain amount of extra access and extra power available to us to manipulate the net that we as stewards are trusted not to abuse. This sort of unilateral action will encourage other nations on and other networks to affect American assets in ways that are not necessarily in our interest. Thank you.
And Daniel.
Thanks. Well, there's a lot of things I want to respond to what Dan said, but first let me set up how I see the debate. When you look at most of the reports that are out there, it's between 15% and 25% of internet traffic that's responsible for, or that's infringing traffic on the internet, of all internet traffic. And when you look at that, a big chunk of that is BitTorrent or peer-to-peer. But a growing part of that are file lockers and video streaming. And the reason this is important, and file lockers are like RabbitShare, Mega Upload, these sites where you can easily dump a big file on. And all this matters because it's become increasingly easy for someone to very quickly register a new domain, set up a new site, stick some ads on there, and be able to make a profit off of streaming copyrighted content. What we need is a fast and flexible response system that can address this problem. And that's what COIC is designed to do. That's why there's really a three-prong approach within it, where it goes after the funding model of these websites. It prohibits the financial transactions that we go to pay for music or movies to gain access to these sites. It would get the ad networks to remove their ads from these sites, and then it would reduce the amount of traffic going to these sites, which obviously reduces ad revenue. So, you know, we can talk about, you know, people get really nervous when you start talking about blocking sites. I mean, you know, that's just the nature of it. But we should all be able to agree that some sites probably should be blocked. That, you know, even if you don't think it's copyright infringing sites, maybe there's, you know, child pornography sites, something should be blocked out there. So then the question is, can we come up with an agreement on what should be blocked and then what measures can be taken to block it? So, you know, there's the question of, is this too broad? That's, I think, a fairly simple issue to solve. I think on the panel we could probably come up with a definition that everyone's happy about that clearly says only sites that are really, truly engaging in infringing content. So, you know, I think there's some agreement that we can come to here.
Well, let's go ahead and start some debate and ripping into each other about this whole title of the panel, which is Will It Work? Dan was talking about how this may affect the DNS if people are going to get around this and are going to be using alternate name servers. Is this going to be just one more example of Congress after the fact trying to shut down something that keeps moving elsewhere and is going to basically be one step behind in technology? This is the case with Napster, which was shut down, in which case decentralized file sharing became very standard. And it seems like there is not really any way so far that our law has managed to keep up with the increasing volume of infringing material. So is this just going to be one more step? Are there better ways to deal with infringement than what's proposed in this legislation? Anyone?
Well, I'm happy to start off by saying nothing's perfect. I think we can all agree, just like in the real world, the non-cyber world, there's no perfect solution to crime. It would be pretty surprising if there was 100% certainty in the online world when we don't have 100% certainty in the offline world. And the question to me is, can we give law enforcement the tools that will at least help to shut things down? And I think, you know, Daniel made a good point. There's a three-pronged effort here. So although part of the solution is to, as in the United States situation, to make sites not accessible or to make it at least harder to access them, that's not the only thing. So I think the burden is on people who think these tools are either worthless or ineffective to come up with something better. Are they perfect? No. Will they help? Yes. Have they helped in the U.S.? Yes.
So my take on that would be that any positive impact from the domain name blocking and seizure provisions of the bill will be entirely ephemeral. There are really easy ways to evade this. I mean, users can type an IP address into their browser instead of the domain name. They can bookmark that. They can use an alternative DNS server. As Dan said, it takes 60 seconds to change to that. They're not complicated and difficult tactics. And what will happen if this technique becomes common on the part of law enforcement, what you're going to see is that the sites and the forums for people who use these sites distributing simple things like browser plugins to automate the process of finding the sites. And the sites will just do this fast flux dance, staying one step ahead of law enforcement, and the tools for finding them will be completely viral and will be well known.
So what's the alternative?
Well, I think it's always an interesting tactic in this debate to say that, well, if we got to do something, and so you know, if someone doesn't have a silver bullet to solve the problem, then heck, let's just adopt whatever it happens to be without doing the cost benefit analysis. I think there's no substitute for cost benefit analysis on the specific techniques that COICA proposes. But I'll say a few things. I mean, number one, I think as a general matter, with law enforcement, we should be seeking to try to go after the actual bad actors and bring them to justice through the normal judicial process whenever we can do that. When you have foreign sites, and that's more difficult, then I think there's you've got a cross-border issue, and there is no substitute for international cooperation. If you look at the IPEX report that the strategy put out by the Intellectual Property Enforcement Coordinator, it talks about cooperation with foreign law enforcement authorities, and you know you've had countries working on ACTA towards that end. I mean, I think ultimately you're going to have to have you're going to have cross-border cooperation to try to bring international bad guys to justice. You know, and then third, I'll say that I think exploring the payment systems is an interesting thing to discuss. That's certainly the way the country addressed the issue of illegal gambling when it chose to legislate on that, went after the payment systems, but it didn't get into the issue of seizing and blocking domain names.
Go ahead. Let me go ahead and respond to the DNS, alternate DNS issue, because that was brought up by Dan and David. I certainly agree that it's, you know, I think it's a fact that it's easy to change your DNS provider. I think you give too much credit to the average internet user, though, to say that they will do this. There's a couple assumptions. Yes, it's easy to change, but will people do it? And then will there be viable alternatives available? So, you know, when you talk about will people do it, well, you know, there's a reason there's a lot of idiot guides out there. You know, the average internet user just really isn't that savvy. But, you know, as Dan mentioned, there are security trade-offs, right? There's a lot of security risk if you're using an alternative DNS, especially if it's an alternative DNS that maybe you don't really trust in a foreign country. There's a lot of privacy risk. You know, your DNS server, you're telling them every site that you're interested in browsing to. They have basically a full history of where you're going. Would you trust a foreign organization that you don't probably know that much about and there might not be any legal protections for? There's performance trade-offs, right? You know, you're not going to your local ISP and using their DNS server. You're going to a foreign country. And then when you start talking about how the internet works in these areas, you know, a lot of the content that most people access is from content distribution networks like Akamai, right? And when you go to a DNS server, the DNS server goes to Akamai, you're getting the closest server, the closest Akamai server to that DNS resolver. So if you're going to one abroad, if you're going to, you know, it's the closest Akamai server in you know, Russia, that's not the closest one to you. There's performance hits that go on here. There's questions of who's actually providing this, right? If you're talking about, you know, the entire American internet population abandoning their local ISP DNS servers, going abroad using foreign DNS servers, who's providing all of these computers? Who's providing all this processing power? And who's paying for all that, right? Are these free services? Are these, you know, servers going to be slow? Is there going to be a performance hit? The reason some people switch from their local ones is because they want a speed improvement. So there's a lot of questions here that I think, you know, users will face. I don't think it's a guarantee that the second, you know, if COICA was passed, that you just see this immediate exodus of internet users. I think there's some, you know, serious questions about, sure, some people would switch. Some people have switched already just because, you know, they're that type of user. But, you know, realistically, no, I don't think a lot of people would switch, and that's why I think it will be effective.
So I'm a very data-driven person. You know, as an engineer, when I try to speak about stuff, I try to have some data behind what I'm arguing. As of today, millions of users are already off their own personal ISP name server. They're using services such as OpenDNS or Google DNS. This is happening because it is a very easy switch to make. The changes proposed by COICA are the sort that lead towards sites simply not working. This is a direct damage between the trust relationship of the user and their ISP. Frankly, every error the user gets is a signal that, wait, something is in the way, something is interfering. You have bad guys between you and whatever. And do I think that the response to that is in fact going to be switching to foreign name servers? Well, what we see in other countries is when the filters get onerous, people start moving en masse to VPN-type solutions. This is we are, as I've joked, a spoiled nation in that we don't have to do anything special to reach, quote-unquote, the real internet. When you actually go overseas, when you actually go to these countries where there are widespread filters, what you actually find, and I've personally done this, is widespread awareness of you have to use proxies, you have to use VPNs, these are the things you have to do to get to quote-unquote the real internet. So unfortunately, the actual data does suggest, yeah, you know, if this is what it's going to take to get access to whatever random album someone wants, people are going to make these changes. And the side effects are, not only are they going to use these foreign servers for accessing pirated material, but they're also going to use these servers for their search engines, for their banking, for their email. And these side effects are really what has me concerned from a security perspective.
Can I just address that data? There's two kind of data points there. One is the number of users who use Google DNS and OpenDNS. Those two, Google is based in the U.S. and OpenDNS is running their servers here in the U.S. too. They're based in the U.S. They would both have to follow COICA. So those types of users would still be within this regime. But I think the other question you bring up, what do people do in other countries? Well, I'm a data-driven guy too, and if you look at the Harvard's Berkman Center, they've done studies on this. What do people in other countries do? They actually found out that it's really low. They just did a study, came out near the end of 2010, that found only about 3% of internet users are using these types of VPN tools, Tor, other proxies to get around filters in countries that significantly restrict access to content. That 3% was their maximum, and they said it's probably substantially lower. So when you look at the data, even in these countries where that's the only way to access the internet, it's still not very high.
So on this sheet from fightonlinetheft.com, I see, quote, traffic generated to 43 sites engaged in digital piracy was more than 146 million visits per day, representing more than 53 billion visits per year. Interest in these sites is remarkably high. For better or worse, this is just what the data, from right in front of me is saying. The 3% rate reflects sites that are blocked, say, without such widespread interest.
Does anybody else want to say anything on this, or should we move on?
Well, I'd just quickly add that I think, in terms of your average internet user, well, there's a whole spectrum of internet users out there. My mother is not going on sites to try to download illegal music and movies. True, she would not have the capacity to route around, but she's not the one doing it in the first place. I think what you're talking here about a motivated user base that is relatively on the high end of the average internet user.
I don't have any numbers, but I do have some personal experience. I have kids who are certainly of the age that I hope they don't access illegal content. My guess is sometimes they do. But I think there's a big difference between being able to access it as easily as you can access any other website and having to put in workarounds that people who are sophisticated enough to employ them may also know of the downsides of them. So I just think we don't know. And I guess the question is, again, I wasn't challenging you for a silver bullet. I think the question just is, as I said before, we need to do something to prevent our internal, the within the U.S. enforcement regime from being rendered meaningless by the fact that there's no enforcement regime with respect to sites outside the U.S. And although international cooperation is a great goal, not surprisingly, most of these sites are in places where the odds of getting cooperation are on the low side, to say the least. So we've got to come up with something. And everything that makes it more difficult is it going to weed out everybody? No. Is it going to weed out some people? Yes. And in combination with some of the other tools, like the rules about the access to the financial network, can have a real substantial and serious effect.
Can I just throw on?
Very quickly.
Yeah, sure. You talk about the interest. I think people are interested in the content. They're not interested in piracy, right? So, I mean, right now, if you search for any of the top blockbuster movies, if you Google, in fact, I Googled last night, if you Google, watch Black Swan, you can find it streaming online in the top 10 search results on Google. That's too easy, right? So the goal is how do you make it so it's not so easy? And that's part of the way of addressing this.
If I can just piggyback on that, so I agree that it's about content. It's not necessarily about folks wanting to do piracy. I think that just highlights one important side note here, which is that it's really the solution here, to the extent there is one, isn't just about enforcement. It's about building legal content distribution models that are attractive enough that people are happy to use them and feel like they can get what they want when they want it at a price point that's attractive. And, you know, I think if the more there are legitimate business models out there that are attractive to people, the less relatively attractive the infringement sites seem. And so I think one thing government can be doing is looking at are there any barriers to building legal sites, to building lawful distribution mechanisms. For example, a few years ago, Congress was looking at simplifying some of the licensing rules. I mean, I think those kinds of things have an important contribution to make.
So it would be completely technically feasible to alter antivirus software so that it could detect pirated content and just block it, shut off the speakers, turn off the screen, or whatnot. And we could totally be up here discussing having antivirus block pirated media. However, there'd be a side effect to that. Nobody would run antivirus. It is not enough to simply say, well, we have to do something, this is something, and therefore we have to do it. It is critical to be aware of the costs of any proposed solution. One thing I'd very much like to see is a formal, deep analysis of what are the technical implications of these changes. They're not small. They're not trivial. You have 90 internet engineers agreeing that this is a major issue. Okay, if you have 90 engineers, you have 180 opinions. Getting 90 of us to agree that this sort of filtering will have tremendous side effects and be ineffective is unprecedented. And that should be cause for some concern.
Let's move on here real quick. I have a question for all of you. How many people actually type in domain names when they look for something, or do they just go to a search engine? Anybody here?
Which one do you want the hands for?
This is actually a discussion that's happened, I know, in my office about are domain names still relevant when most of us are using search engines or other ways to go to places. That also brings up the question that's often brought up by opponents of legislation like this is that the best place to find, let's say, a torrent is going through Google. And Google clearly has non-infringing purposes. So let's go into the subject area of exactly what is primarily infringing, whether there are going to be hosting platforms that have been known to be a popular place for this material but are also used for other lawful materials. I'm using Dropbox actually right now to share documents back and forth with somebody, just personal documents. Is that going to be hit here? What is going to be the result? Is the government going to be stuck trying to argue that this is primarily infringing when it's a really close call?
Let me say, I think it's a crucially important question, and I think it goes to what we debated a little bit about during our opening remarks about breadth. The definition in COICA that I think Andrew was quoting from, he quoted from one prong of the definition, but there's two prongs to the definition, and the first prong is a statutory cross-reference, and the statute it cross-references just says that a site has to be used or intended to be used in any means or by any part to facilitate or commit criminal copyright infringement. So it's actually just any site involved in copyright infringement on any scale is potentially subject to COICA. And the reason it comes back to your question, I think, is that we just saw the Chamber of Commerce, I think a couple weeks ago, put out a report talking about the extent of what they consider digital piracy sites, and some of the ones it mentioned were things like RapidShare. So these are sites where there's certainly a lot of infringement going on RapidShare, I don't doubt it, but these are ultimately sites that are setting up, like Dropbox, a communications capability that users can employ as users see fit. And I think it's a big question whether we're going to, with a law like COICA, start having a process that can target sites that are building communications and storage and data sharing capabilities, general capabilities, and then declaring some of them to be blockable based on how some users are using them when in fact it's used for a whole multitude of purposes.
You're talking about the civil forfeiture cross-references. I want to be sure.
That's correct.
Yeah, so the statute says there are two things, what I read and then anything otherwise subject to civil forfeiture. That, of course, is a rule that applies now to sites that are hosted or located within the U.S., and I think that sort of the proof is in the pudding. Google's here. A lot of these sites are here. This is government enforcement. This isn't private enforcement. So I think we can take some comfort from the fact that, as the government has shown in the way that it's exercised this enforcement authority domestically, it's not going after sites like Google that have real-world uses and that no one would say should fall within this. But it is going after, as it did this fall, some sites that were engaged, you know, very, very dramatically in infringement. So I think, again, part of the argument, just to go back to where I was before, is let's have the same rules apply inside the U.S., and this is a rule that today applies inside the U.S., outside the U.S. That's not a big change.
You know, I just wanted to add, you know, I think, you know, what's important here is you have good actors and you have bad actors. The good actors here are using tools like content identification to see if, you know, what content's on their servers, what content is copyrighted and take action, and what content isn't and leave that alone. And so government won't go after them. And, you know, they also respond, of course, to notices of copyright infringement. And that's, I think, one of the most important distinctions when you talk about, you know, the comparison, you know, Dan, you made to antivirus versus a DNS server, right? Antivirus isn't really an intermediary in the transaction here. A DNS server is. And so the question is, a DNS server's kind of job is to translate domain names to IP addresses, right? So, you know, the question is, does it always have to do that job, or what happens when it knows that it's being asked for something that's, you know, being directed to an illegal site? Does it still have a responsibility to give the correct answer? Arguably, no. That same comparison doesn't really apply for antivirus.
Antivirus could just as easily block LimeWire as it blocks any piece of malware. You know, you could just say, well, when antivirus sees that it's being used to load something that could be used to infringe copyright, maybe it shouldn't allow that to happen. But again, the side effects are nobody runs antivirus. One of the things that I'm really worried about here, and I mentioned this earlier, was the unilateral nature of this action. I mean, the DNS is a shared entity. It is absolutely critical to the functioning of the Internet. Without a doubt, the Internet does not work without a shared medium by which names can be registered. And we talked about balkanization earlier. You know, you could go ahead and you can define Gmail as a site that could be used to facilitate copyright infringement. You could define Hotmail, you know, pretty much anything that allows bits to move. I mean, if I wanted to be creative, I can turn an instant messenger into a tool for the management of piracy. And what happens when you have 250 countries out there that are all looking at, well, so apparently it's okay for us to unilaterally block sites? What you see is the continuation of a what's been called the largest undeclared trade war in history, of in which countries do which sites work. As a nation that does build sites, and actually this is one of our primary sources of, you know, creative economy, I have a lot of concern with what this opens up other countries to be encouraged to do.
If I can jump in with one more thing, I think there's a procedural issue with the bill, too. I mean, we're debating how you can distinguish between bad sites that deserve some kind of sanction. Under the bill, what you have is a process where there's no adversarial process, there's no advance notice, there's no opportunity for a site to defend itself. So if a site is accused under COICA of being worthy of blocking, it doesn't get to come in and defend itself before it gets blocked or seized, but I should say before its domain name gets blocked or seized. It doesn't get that opportunity. So I think that when you have a process where it's basically just the prosecutor coming in and saying this is a site dedicated to infringing activity, and there's no one presenting the other side of the case, you have a real risk that sites that in fact are multi-purpose sites with some infringing uses and some non-infringing uses get tagged in the blockable category, and there's the bill allows a process for them to come in after the fact and try to reclaim their domain name, but it seems like it's basically a, you know, guilty until proven innocent kind of situation, and the remedies are only after the fact and after there's been some damage to that site's ability to speak.
Can I just correct you? I think it's not quite right about notice. I think the statute actually requires the Attorney General, when he commences the action, to give reasonable notice, and I think there would be a constitutional problem if there wasn't a reasonable notice standard. Now, whether you can actually know the person obviously is a problem, because there's in the U.S., obviously the registrars have the real people. That may not be true in other places around the world. So it may be that because of local requirements or the use of fictitious names, you may not actually be able to give actual notice to the person. But I think the statute pretty clear, or the bill pretty clearly requires that there be given, there be a sort of attempt, reasonable attempt to provide notice, because I think that would be a requirement. Let me just address the balkanization argument, because obviously it's a problem, and there are a lot of countries that block things now, and the United States vigorously protests that. I think one of the characteristics here, though, is that the legal rules, the copyright and trademark rules that are the basis for action and enforcement action here are rules that have been agreed to around the world. So in terms of what the United States can say that it's doing, it seems to me, is saying it's enforcing rules that have been agreed to virtually universally, some 150-plus countries, which is obviously very different than other countries enforcing standards that don't have that kind of universal recognition.
I just, you know, wanted to say, you know, David, I agree with what you said, that, you know, there's certainly room to look and see about what is appropriate notice and is there proper judicial oversight in the bill. You know, but I would say I don't think in the fast-moving world of, you know, how easy it is to set up a site and the need to respond quickly, I think there's a question of can you do something preemptively in the offline world. If you see somebody shoplifting, you can stop them. You don't have to go and give them notice and, you know, have a hearing before. You can have a temporary time where you can, you know, arrest someone. And I'm wondering if you think there's something equivalent that could be set up in the online world.
I think the equivalent thing is you arrest a shoplifter. You don't go ahead and do dramatic things to supermarkets. You arrest the guy. And that's, you know, I mean, I'm joking, but that's the model that needs to be taken. If there are bad guys, and we have this consensus in 150 countries, arrest the guy.
But the problem is some countries don't enforce the laws that they've agreed to. So, you know, what do? You've got to have some kind of you need some enforcement mechanism that works, because unlike in the pre-internet era where it really didn't matter if somebody was selling pirated books on some street corner in pick your country, because that wasn't going to impact the U.S. market, now we do. And so the fact that we have an online world means that there are going to have to be different enforcement mechanisms to recognize that reality that are tempered by a lot of the other constraints that we're talking about. But you have to recognize the reality. And I guess my analogy might not be the shoplifter. My analogy might be the store that's selling only illegal content or virtually only illegal content. You know, maybe they also give away copies of the Constitution for free. No question that store can be shut down today if it's in America. The question is, what do you do in the online world to set up the kind of equivalency to that remedy?
Let's talk about some voluntary measures that are in this bill. The Justice Department blacklist is gone from the approved version, but there is still this wide immunity for intermediaries, for payment systems or for payment processors, for others who are part of this revenue stream to decide on their own, this is infringing, we don't want to carry it, and we are, because of this bill, we are not worried about incurring some kind of liability. I'm curious how often this model has been used before, where the government encourages some intermediary to do the right thing, even if it's not by court order, and how willing have they been to do that? Is this going to set up a situation where there are large numbers of shutdowns happening outside of any kind of court review?
Well, I mean, I certainly have some concern about the possibility of sort of vigilante actions that could sweep too broadly. I think there's some risk there. You know, on the other hand, I'm not entirely sure why that particular provision of the bill is necessary. I mean, I think it's the case that most of these online services, payment services and so forth, have terms of service that will generally say that you're not supposed to use our service for illegal purposes, and, you know, we reserve the right to stop serving you if you're doing that. So strikes me that the capacity is already there for services to say we don't support people doing illegal things, and if they're doing illegal things, we're not going to have our service be a part of that.
Anyone else?
I'm just in my real life, I'm a litigator. You know, people are always nervous about being sued. And I think people, even though you have the legal right, in order to exercise it, people often want some more comfort. So I think the question is there something wrong with doing it if it's going to make them more comfortable to do something that makes sense, but obviously not, you know, you don't want something that opens the door to abuse. I'm not sure this provision does, but I think, you know, people often are looking for some protection because they're just afraid of the possibility of litigation, even if they're exercising some right that they might have under the contract, because the other side says, oh, no, you don't.
Moving on. Let's talk a little bit about how this might affect internet governance, because the issue has been raised that this may raise some problems at ICANN with the U.S. kind of using its special relationship to the creation of the internet to have undue influence over lawful content, let's say, in other countries, but that have some tie here. They're registered here. The registry is here. Will this raise issues going forward with other countries who will see this as an indication that we can take maybe a more active approach than we had before and cause problems down the road in terms of how countries actually agree how the internet is run?
So we're right now in the middle of spreading a technology called DNSSEC. And I don't want to bore all you guys with the technical details, but DNSSEC has two things to be aware of. First off, we've had a lot of trouble securing the internet. I don't know if you've noticed, but there's a lot of stuff that's not working. DNSSEC is going to fix that, but it has a dependency. And its core dependency is that DNS remains a trusted shared medium. I can't fix stuff without DNSSEC. Period. And I can't get DNSSEC if out there everyone's wondering what the United States is going to do to the DNS next. Now, I just got back from Europe, and I just talked with a whole bunch of people and worked with a bunch of people, and what they're telling me is that they're terrified. They don't know what's going to happen to DNS from day to day. And they already weren't big fans of ICANN, but now they've got evidence. Now they've got signs that changes are coming, and it's going to get even more fragmented. And this causes me problems because I need DNSSEC if I'm going to go ahead and fix a lot of our problems with authentication and trust on the internet. And seeing all of this argument happen is really diminishing my credibility out there in the rest of the world.
Anyone else?
Sure. So I do think that other countries are have been concerned for a long time about the U.S.'s special role with respect to the formation of the internet and our control over some of the key pieces of the internet's architecture, how those are in this country, and therefore we have some greater ability to exercise jurisdiction. And, you know, you see it with the domain name seizures to date. I mean, .com and .net are based here, so that gives us a certain amount of control. I think that because other countries are leery of that and are worried about how the U.S. might use that, that figures into how they're going to perceive something like COICA. I think when we've talked about the international implications so far on this panel, I know that the point's been made well. What we're doing is substantively good. It reflects agreements that have been accepted worldwide in intellectual property treaties. I actually think other countries may be looking less at the substance of what we're doing and more at the process. And we'll see it as the U.S. trying to increasingly aggressively assert domestic law over foreign sites, and I think it will be a green light for other countries to try to do likewise. I think they will be worried about U.S. increasingly asserting a heavy hand, and they'll want to be able to do the same.
Does anybody else want to say?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say, I mean, I think other countries are going to do it anyway. I don't think, I mean, they have done it already. There's, I think, over 40 countries that are identified as having some type of filtering in place. I mean, that's just the nature of the internet. We call it global, but it's not completely global. There are, you know, different internets in each country, different sites that are accessible. And, you know, we've been able to live with it pretty well until now. You know, there are questions about DNSSEC and how it can be deployed. And I think a serious question to the designers of DNSSEC is, if you have so many countries who are saying that we want to do some type of filtering, and if some of these countries want to do it through DNS, how can we do it in a way that's still secure? Because it's still important to have a secure internet, even in countries that choose to do that. And that's something that, you know, has been addressed. Some people have already started looking at that, how they can add an extension to DNSSEC, so countries that, or you know, DNS servers that don't want to resolve certain IP addresses can do it in a way that's still authenticating the end-to-end security and integrity of what they're telling the client.
Go ahead.
As the guy who'd have to build this stuff, I promise you any of these systems get really ugly really fast and frankly will make DNSSEC less secure.
If that's all, I think we're going to open it up to questions right now. Any questions? Tom?
I think we should ramp things down below the point where we're equating Lady Gaga with dead bodies. I'm just saying. No, I'm fully aware that the European Union has done a lot of work around intellectual property and about setting the standards and setting the rules. My critique is on the technical basis that has been prescribed. Insufficient, you know, that they're concerned about intellectual property does not mean that this particular solution is the appropriate path to take. And frankly, insufficient technical analysis has been done on what are the side effects here. Arrest the bad guys. And if you don't have consensus to arrest the bad guys, that's the direction to move in. Because at the end of the day, if we know who these people are and we can't arrest them because there isn't the consensus, then you're operating on the wrong layer to try to make up for it by hitting the wire.
Okay, let's move on to the next question here.
Hi, Maxim.
Get that?
Hi, Maxim Weinstein from Scott Badware. COICA is very interesting in the sense that it creates what really is a very generic legal framework for taking down, and I'm using that term very loosely, for taking down a website that is undesirable. Very, very specific focus on intellectual property sites, while ignoring other types of undesirable sites like malware, phishing, and so on, which are arguably more dangerous to Americans than to everyone else on the internet. And so So this is kind of a two-part question. The first question is for Dan, and it's a question around the kinds of concerns you were raising about if people want to get to the content, they're going to get to it. How would that change if we were talking about this same mechanism for things like malware? And the second part of the question is for anyone who wants to answer it, which is there a good reason, apart from who has the lobbying dollars, to create this legal framework in legislation and then make it so narrowly focused on only IP and not on some of these other potentially threatening sites?
To refer to the first half of your question, my sense is that energy spent trying to do these ineffective filters against piracy operations is going to make it harder to use DNS filtering to affect malware. At the end of the day, we actually did do a massive 100-country operation to try to manage the flow of the Conficker worm, which did in fact end up infecting 8 million machines, including several at hospitals. You want to talk about dead bodies? Yes, there were actually potential for that there. The more we push users away from their local servers, the less we're going to be able to manage the actual malware phishing attacks that are affecting our financial infrastructure and many other systems. And for your second half, I'll leave it to the panel.
Well, I'll say the issue that you raise is certainly one that I'm concerned about. I mean, I think if we were to adopt this kind of approach with respect to intellectual property, I suspect there'd be plenty of other folks coming in and saying, well, wait a minute, there's other kinds of objectionable content on the internet. We should use this approach to stop that too. And, you know, my concern with that is ultimately I think that this tactic of going after domain names is one that has all the problems we've talked about. I also think it's going to have sharply diminishing and negative returns. I think it's the kind of thing that if you use it at all, it's got to be used sparingly, because the more it's used, the less effective it's going to be, and the more we're going to have all these negative consequences for cybersecurity and so forth. So I think it is a big problem that we'd be setting a precedent here that I suspect would be followed in other areas.
Next question.
Hi, this is Milton Mueller from Syracuse University. I wanted to get back to the subject of DNSSEC. I think it's very important, and I don't want to encourage you to go off on technical tangents, but I really want to understand, and maybe it should be Daniel and Andrew who answer this question and not Mr. Kaminsky. Tell me how you block these domains by regulating domain name servers that have implemented DNSSEC. I mean, what happens in terms of the compatibility, the exchanges of keys, the public keys, the private keys? How do you make COICA consistent with the implementation of DNSSEC? It's a question. I don't know the answer. Tell me.
Sure. I mean, you know, there's a couple of ways you can look at it. One is, you know, DNSSEC can be implemented different ways, right? So do you send the authenticated answer to the client, or do you just send it to the DNS resolver or the DNS cacher, right? So the DNS cacher could have an authenticated answer, and then they look up the blacklist and they say, you know, these are the ones I'm not going to send a reply to, or these are the ones where I end up sending, you know, a black hole to. Right? And so Paul Vixie has proposed an extension that would have a reputation management for DNS. And the idea is that, you know, we use blacklists already for spam. You know, it's being used by OpenDNS to you know, as other people said, look at blocking, you know, malware, spyware to do parental controls. It's used routinely, and people like this. People, you know, choose to use this as a service. So, you know, there is a question of, you know, is that a flaw in the implementation of DNSSEC? How do you change it so that instead of just saying, you know, this site isn't here, which, you know, that's not really a correct answer, right? So how can you give a correct answer that still is a secure solution? And, you know, I think there's no one question, you know, the people who designed it, you know, Dan, you're kind of involved in this. I don't think you think that should be done. So, you know, is that why it's not in there? Maybe.
If all we were discussing was that DNS, that you should get a message saying, by the way, this site you're going to might be malicious, it'd be a completely different discussion. I mean, one of the things, I think this was in your paper, was talking about how do you differentiate Amazon.com from all of MP3.com? How does someone know when they're spending money that they're spending money at an approved legal site? And that's kind of what reputation systems allow you to do. And let me tell you, I have no objection to that. I think that's a value add, in fact. What is being proposed in the COICA equivalent, though, is something more. It's not just you get extra information, you get less information. And the specific feature that the filtering conflicts with is called authoritative non-existence. It's where you actually get a message saying, this name you looked up does not exist, and here's some proof. And in a proper DNSSEC implementation, if you don't get that message, if you don't get that signed thing saying this domain doesn't exist, the response is bogus. You are on a hostile network. There is a bad guy. You are in trouble. And those sorts of replies are problematic, because those are the kind of replies that encourage a user to leave the actual hostile network that's giving them unverified data and go to one that is, in fact, giving them verified data.
Right, so it seems like the solution...
I'm going to cut you off here. We have to wrap up, so this is going to be our last question here.
Hi, Richard Bennett with ITIF. I work with Daniel on these issues. I wanted to just reinforce you brought up Paul Vixie's work on reputation-based systems to enhance DNS. I'd really encourage people to read the blog post that Paul wrote. Paul Vixie, by the way, is the guy that wrote Bind, and so pretty much he's the guy that makes DNS work, if there is one guy. Mm-hmm. He wrote a blog post on CircleID about a year ago called Taking Back the DNS that highlights the fact that the majority of new DNS registrations today are for malicious sites. And so there's kind of a whole lot of the internet design that's naive, and DNS is one of those areas where when the majority of new DNS registrations are for malicious sites, you know, there is a problem here. And I asked Paul specifically whether he thought the COICA approach would work, and he said, of course it'll work. But there's no question that it'll work, especially for the class of user that it's targeted toward, which is somebody who goes and spends money with a credit card transaction to download unlicensed content on a site that looks like a legitimate store. Now, clearly there is a class of user for whom it won't work, but those people aren't spending money, so they're not really the target anyway.
So the last time I spoke to Paul Vick, we worked together for 6 months on that DNS fix. And the last comment from him was that I talked to him about COICA was, fair amount of horror. Now, RPZ was not designed for stopping this. It was designed for dealing with the horrible flood of actual aggressively malicious hosts that are trying to break into American assets, steal our emails, steal our money. I mean, there's a world of badness out there above and beyond IP theft. The simple reality is that just like if you abused antivirus to use this, no one would use antivirus. If you abuse RPZ, you're going to lose that feature. And that's just the reality.
I think we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you for coming to this panel. We're going to go to the Grand Ballroom now for lunch. And Howard Schmidt, Ed Amoroso are speaking. If you want to talk to any of our panelists, look for them up here or around the conference. Thank you. Yeah.